It was almost always to Amos that the economists wrote. They understood him. Amos's insistently logical mind was much like their own, but somehow better. They could see his genius. To most economists, Danny's mind was a mystery. Richard Zeckhauser, an economist at Harvard who became friends with Amos, spoke for his entire field when he said, "My impression of the way they worked on a paper is that they walked around and let Danny do a variety of things. Guess what, Amos? I went to buy a car and I offered 38 grand, and the salesman said 38.9, and I said yes. Did I do a good job?" And Amos would say, "Let's write that up." The economist's view of the collaboration was that Amos Tversky had set out, like an anthropologist, to study an alien tribe of beings less rational than himself, and his tribe was Danny. "I share your feeling that such behavior is in some sense unwise or erroneous, but this does not mean that it does not occur," Amos wrote, to an American economist who complained about the description of human nature implied by value theory. "A theory of vision cannot be faulted for predicting optical illusions. Similarly, a descriptive theory of choice cannot be rejected on the grounds that it predicts irrational behavior if the behavior in question is, in fact, observed." Danny, for his part, claimed that it wasn't until 1976 that he woke up to the effects their theory might have on a field he knew nothing about. His awakening came when Amos handed him a paper written by an economist. The paper opened, "The agent of economic theory is rational, selfish, and his tastes do not change." The economists at Hebrew University were in the building next door, but Danny hadn't paid any attention to their assumptions about human nature. "To me, the idea that they really believed in it, that this is really their worldview, was incredible," he said. "It's the worldview in which if people tip in a restaurant to which they will never return, it counts as a puzzle." It was a worldview that took it as given that the only way to change people's behavior was to change their financial incentives. The idea of it struck him as so bizarre that he could scarcely bring himself to engage with it directly. To Danny, the whole idea of proving that people weren't rational felt a bit like proving that people didn't have fur. Obviously, people were not rational in any meaningful sense of that term. He and Amos wanted to avoid getting into an argument about the rationality of man. That argument would only distract people from the phenomenon they were uncovering. They preferred to reveal man's nature and let man decide what he was. Their next task, they saw, was to buff and polish value theory for publication. They both worried that someone would find an obvious contradiction, some allay paradox-like observation that would render their theory dead on arrival. They'd spend 3 years doing very little else but searching the theory for internal contradictions. "In those 3 years, we did not discuss anything of genuine interest," said Danny. Danny's interest ended with the psychological insights. Amos was obsessed with the business of using the insights to create a structure. What Amos saw, perhaps more clearly than Danny, was that the only way to force the world to grapple with their insights into human nature was to embed them in a theory. That theory needed to explain and predict behavior better than existing theory, but it also needed to be expressed in symbolic logic. "What made the theory important and what made it viable were completely different," said Danny years later. "Science is a conversation, and you have to compete for the right to be heard. And the competition has its rules. And the rules, oddly enough, are that you are tested on formal theory." After they finally sent a draft of their paper to the economics journal Econometrica, Danny was perplexed by the editor's response. "I was kind of hoping he'd say, 'Loss aversion is a really cool idea.' He said, 'No, I like the math.' I was sort of shattered." By 1976, purely for marketing purposes, they changed their title to Prospect Theory. The idea was to give the theory a completely distinct name that would have no associations whatsoever, said Danny. "When you say prospect theory, no one knows what you're talking about. We thought, who knows, it may turn out to be influential. And if it is, we don't want it to be confused with anything else." In all of this, they were slowed dramatically by the turmoil in Danny's life. By 1974, he'd moved out of his house and was living apart from his wife and children. A year later, he left the marriage and flew to London to meet the psychologist Anne Treisman to formally declare my love. She reciprocated. By the fall of 1975, Amos was clearly weary of the inevitable fallout. "It is hard to overestimate the amount of time and the amount of emotional and mental energy that is consumed with such affairs, he wrote to his friend Paul Slovak. In October 1975, Danny flew to England again, this time to see Anne in Cambridge and to travel with her to Paris. He was at once in a totally uncharacteristic state of elation and worried about the effect of his new relationship with Anne on his old one with Amos. In Paris, he found waiting what appeared to be a letter from Amos, but opening it, he at first found only a draft of what would become prospect theory. Danny took the absence of any personal note as a subtle message from Amos. Sitting with his new love in the world's capital of romance, Danny sat down and wrote what amounted to a love letter to Amos. "Dear Amos," it began, "when I came to Paris, I found an envelope from you. I pulled out your manuscript, but there was no letter with it. And I told myself that Amos is very angry with me, and not without reason. After dinner, I was looking for a used envelope to send this back to you, and I found your envelope, and then saw your letter inside. We were late for dinner, and I just glanced to see how you finish it, and I saw the words, 'Yours as ever,' and I had goosebumps from emotion." He went on to write that he'd explained to Anne that he could never have achieved on his own what he had achieved with Amos, and that the new paper they were working on was yet another step. "This is for me the greatest moment in a relationship which I see as one of the peaks of my life," he wrote. Then he added, "I was yesterday at Cambridge, and I spoke to them about our work on value theory. The enthusiasm is almost embarrassing. I concluded with a discussion of the early stages of the isolation effect, and they responded to that especially. In general, they gave me the feeling that I'm one of the world's greats. They were trying so hard to impress me that I reached the conclusion that maybe the time has come for me to be free of the need to impress others." In some strange way, as they approached their moment of greatest public triumph, their collaboration remained a private affair, a gamble with no context. "As long as we stayed in Israel, the whole idea of what the world thought of us didn't occur to us," said Danny. "We benefited from our isolation." That isolation depended on them being together, in the same room, behind a closed door. That door was now cracking open. Anne was British. She was also a Gentile and the mother of four children, one of whom had Down syndrome. There were about 16 different reasons she couldn't or wouldn't move to Israel, and if Anne wasn't moving to Israel, it followed that Danny would need to leave. Danny and Amos scrambled and found a temporary solution in 1977 by heading off together from Hebrew University on sabbatical to Stanford University, where Anne might join them. But a few months after their arrival in the United States, Danny announced that he planned to marry Anne and stay. He forced Amos to make a decision about what to do about their relationship. It was now Amos's turn to sit down and write an emotional letter. Danny was messy in a way that Amos could never be messy, even if he wanted to be. Amos had wanted to be a poet when he was a boy. He'd wound up a scientist. Danny was a poet who somehow happened to have become a scientist. Danny felt some obvious desire to be more like Amos. Amos, too, harbored some less obvious desire to be more like Danny. Amos was a genius, but he needed Danny, and he knew it. The letter Amos wrote was to his close friend Gidon Chapsky, the rector of Hebrew University. "Dear Giddy," it began, "the decision to remain here in the United States is the most difficult decision I have ever made. I cannot ignore my desire to bring to a completion, at least partially, the joint work with Danny. I just cannot accept the idea that the joint work of years would come to naught and that we will not be able to complete the ideas we have." Amos went on to explain that he planned to accept a chaired professorship offered to him by Stanford University. He knew full well that everyone in Israel would be shocked and angry. "If Danny leaves Israel, it is a personal tragedy," a Hebrew University official had said to him not long before. "If you leave, it is a national tragedy." Until Amos actually left, his friends found it unthinkable that he would live any place but Israel. Amos was Israel, and Israel was Amos. Even his American wife was upset. Barbara had fallen in love with Israel, its intensity, its sense of community, its disinterest in small talk. She now thought of herself as more Israeli than American. "I had done so much work to become Israeli," she said. "I didn't want to stay in the States." I said to Amos, "How can I start over?" He said, "You'll manage."